Okay, where are we at now? We are going to look at and let our historical imaginations run wild on God the Homebreaker. Maybe the easiest way to start is like with free association, like words or other things that connect.
Personal and biblical.
Yeah. Maybe those kind of loose categories.
Famous definition by Robert Frost the higher death of the hired man goes something like, home is where they, when you come, they have to take you
in. When you have to go there, they have to
take you in. Yes, and when you have to go there, they have to take you in.
That's home.
And what is home in death of the hired man? There's a dialogue from home by Frost. My first is something like, what is home? Or, they say, home is when you have to go there, they have to take you in. There's got to be some place, but exception, where you're not, you're kind of.
But that would say something very basic and fundamental. The last place, the last.
And where you are, except there's some place where they can't send you on and say no. Well, we'll put you off for a while. Then you've got to cook.
Does everyone have a home place?
Does everyone have a home?
Yeah, it's a home guarantee.
Is there a place where somebody is going to be sent?
What did Jesus say about that? When people ask, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said, the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. That's interesting. And Jesus, the home bringer, was homeless. That may say something about the home. What was home for Israel?
Sharks pick up on these buttons, don't you?
So it's a place, it's a state of mind. The promised land is a place, the promised land is a state of mind. I don't know if that's
Sidler and Jesus both said this, something about the parable with the man being found in his right mind, the finding way home. That image for me at least ties in with the idea of coming home. And so in some ways, to come to an understanding of truth may be coming home. It's not as connected to history and events.
Well, when we come to Jesus, that's considered coming home, isn't it? I mean, to a lot of people, that's fine.
What did he say about that? Come to me. I will give you.
I will give you a.
And I will give you
rest.
Rest.
Remember the issue of rest in the Promised Land every 7 years? Okay, what is that? The Shabbat is a home in time. I think that's what Heschel would say. It's a time to rest in time. In the seventh year, Jubilee. What else about them?
One thing, when I think about the Promised Land in the New Testament, I think about the kingdom of God. I mean, to me, those are the same thing.
Okay.
The kingdom of God and the Promised Land. I don't know if that's good at home.
Probably lies. I mean, that for me raises all sorts of other images that are connected with it. The kingdom of God is like
garden.
Yeah, okay. The garden, the very first story.
And the promised land is land of milk and honey, or, presented in terms of a congenial environment, a natural landscape.
Is there some reason it's in two different columns?
No, I'll take that out of there. that isn't making congenial. Okay. You said congenial.
Congenial, so actually, it's a place of origin. I have this home, your place of origin.
What do you think?
Your beginning.
I'm not sure it is anymore.
That's at odds with the promised land in some way, it seems.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking of the home in the mind. Or
a home is where you feel comfortable. If you feel comfortable at, you know, where you were brought into the world, then you're, you know, that's your home. But if you don't feel comfortable with that, I don't think that's necessarily your home.
Okay. Home is, you know, homeland, that thing has always, you know, like in the Iliad and whatnot, it's grounded a place to go back to. You know, and it does relate to origins.
Yeah, I was, because it could be more than biological origin.
Uh-huh.
In that, in this sense, I mean, sometimes it can happen in people or in communities. There's some fundamental change that happens to you, transformation that's associated with a place, and that place then is a kind of sacredness. And when you return to it, there's a, I don't know, pure home, but it's a kind of a feeling of coming back to your origins or your beginnings, in the sense that if you're a new person, if, you know, if you think of origins in other than a biological way, I don't know if that makes sense.
I feel like I've experienced that, but could you give an example so I can...
Okay, yeah, here's a very mundane example. Homecoming week at colleges. Mm-hmm. Often colleges and universities, people look back on nostalgically as a place where they underwent a transformation, mm-hmm. or a shift in their life. They didn't begin there in some sense, but in some sense they did. They were altered by the experience. And so when they return to college, there's a feeling of coming home.
Mm-hmm.
And the weekend, homecoming weekend, conveys that feeling. It may be that feeling deepens as you get older. That is, you know, homecomings just a couple of years out of college don't have quite that resonance. But you know, 20, 30 years out of college, there is this sense of returning to a kind of beginning or an early part. I don't know. That's a kind of hooky, mundane thing, but it's an indication that there are places other than the place where you very first began your life that you think of as home or returning
to. Yeah, my dad came from Norway when he was 7 years old, and it was a kind of a ritual that we would go back to visit that little house in Wisconsin. And it was many years before he got back to Norway. But and those events aren't by any means the earliest memory, but very formative. I put down here, home, is it an origin? Is it your place of origin, place of destination, or place of a crucial event? And indicated there might be some sort of tension there. And I thought of that when you said, was it some, when this first came up, the people of Israel were in Egypt, and they came out of it to the land. But then the memory, the expanded narrative talked about the predecessors, the patriarchs and matriarchs, who lived in the land in the first place. And to go into Egypt was to leave home. And so wilderness wandering and the Exodus was not only going to your destination, but it was also a place going back to your origins. And so the story worked. But then there's the very significant part of the story that Abraham comes and Sarah come from outside the promised land again. And the story begins with them as wanderers. But then just previous to that is the story of everyone gathered in one place speaking the same language at Babel. And that ends with a scattering. And there is sort of a movement here. I think all the way back to the garden when Adam and Eve are tossed out of home. Okay. So I think one thing that we can probably count on is there will be a tension between whether the home is a place where you began and will recognize it as such, or whether it's a destination and it really is will be surprising. But Jerry,
why can't home be where you are? I mean, that's completely left out of that little triangle there. If you're really at one with yourself, I would think home, and, you know, if you have everything together, I would think home could be just about anywhere. And a present, ongoing thing instead of something that happened in the past or something that I'm going to, or, you know, some major change.
So the question is, are we ever home?
Or are we always home?
That's kind of like the kingdom of God, though, in that it's a present reality, yet it's to come. It's like, to some extent, we've realized it here, but not fully. You know, I don't know that, you know, it's that same kind of tension between yes and not yet.
Okay, that is a good question, Jerry. It is left out of here. I have to admit, in the story, as I read the Old Testament, there is a certain ambiguity about it. You know, whether the wilderness wandering, the precarious existence of the wilderness, or the existence of the land is really the most precious memory.
There's one other element that might play in there a little bit, be the one of security. And my younger friends that this often is related with the desire to procreate and begin raising families and things, to get to a point or a place or a situation where there is that security and relaxation and trust and things working out, and then, you know, you're strong enough faith to want to continue and raise families. I think it's a lot harder to do that when you're out wandering around all by yourself. Well, not very found by, you know. But it seems to, like Wendell Berry's getting at that too when he talks about the land and sexuality, and that session where you get to that good relationship all the way around, you know, with yourself and your other person, and that has a security and, you know, respectful.
But that's an interesting thing, then, like you're always at home. Partly the question is whether that can be true biblically. That's the call is to be in the world but not of it. If you're always at home, you're very comfy with Caesar. And you know, it's very hard to be religious, called by God, have a relationship to God, and be always at home in the world as it is. But even apart from that, the question of marriage raises this, whether you're at home, because you marry, you achieve a sense of oneness, harmony, security to raise children, but in a marriage, over a length of time, you lose it, and you come back to it. I mean, marriage isn't a static, aha, now I have, you know, now those early, that early wandering is over from now on.
It goes kind of like this.
Yeah, right. It's a losing and a regaining.
David, then
you. I got here a little bit late, but I don't see identity in the Lord. And I guess home to me, and we've been sort of talking around it, security and marriage and our relationship to Caesar, that identity is who you are or who you are becoming. And that changes, and that's a dynamic thing also. And so you can at times be at home where you are, but most of the time, for example, if you're in a situation that you don't particularly care for, you have a job that just sucks or something is not jiving right, you wouldn't want to call that home. That you don't identify with that. That's not part of you, or you don't want to let it be part of you, or our relationship to the government. And I guess for me, it's bound up a lot with identity, and I think that sort of encompasses a bit of what we're talking about. At least in something here.
Okay, are we ever at home in our identity? Yes. In our vocation, hardly ever.
I don't even know about identity. Yes, I think that's another one, like the kingdom of God, sort of the tension of, okay, yeah, we have an identity, but there's still more there.
So the answer is, are we at?
Yes and no.
Ever at home?
Always.
Yes. You would like, you'd say always? Or?
No, I mean, are we ever at home, or yes and no, always?
Yes.
We're
yes
always
and
yes
no,
and always no.
Okay. That seems to be something that, well, that addresses our immediate present situation. The theme last summer at Holden was, how can we sing the Lord's song? I was thinking from Psalm 137. How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? It was the lament of exiles. And the point was that in many ways, the people of God as a community, we're in a strange land. And so that the answer from that perspective was no. We are not at home now. Maybe it'd be helpful to explore that a little bit and say, in what ways are we not at home? What?
Well, like, from my understanding of that psalm, what that came out of, for instance, was the feeling that God had actually left them. And, you know, and that feeling when you've been totally left would bring the feeling that we can't possibly be at home. Whereas if they would have seen God as active in that, I think they could have had a relationship there where they weren't at home, but they still had, home available to them. They were at home. But without God, they were obviously at home.
Okay. I don't know if I had to say the presence of God is somehow related to whether we're home or not.
Well, it would have been, in that sense.
And one of the things the prophets, interesting, one of the things the prophets did, on one hand, they said, you will come home. I mean, physically go back to the land. On the other hand, like the second Isaiah would say, you are exercising your vocation now in being a suffering servant. You are home because you're doing, you're practicing your calling. Very different sorts of things.
I don't know if in that psalm, that they are discounting God, that they are saying that God is that God has left them. They're still addressing God in the psalm. It's one of those still got an awful lot of tension there. They don't understand what the situation is or why this could possibly happen to them. But still they're addressing their anger directly to God and their captors.
Okay. There are other psalms that do ask why God is being so, taking so long and embarrassing himself in front of the eyes of the world by letting these people that call on his name be so humiliated.
I'm just throwing something out of what we did. From what we are there, I can see us moving in one direction, which is becoming more theological,
yeah,
more interpretive. But part of this was an exercise in biblical imagination.
Okay.
And one thing that might get lost in there that we might do is using what we have on the board now simply to recall concrete experiences we have had involving home or these things, and simply recounting them, briefly, and letting them work, that is, historical events, and not just what happened to the Jews, so that can be a part of it, but that too can be rather abstract, or whatever, but experiences we've had in terms of identity, or homes that really weren't our homes, or losing home, anecdotal stuff, because that may have a kind of richness or resonance that will get lost. Well, I'm wondering, is that biblical, is that part of this sort of thing?
What this exercise should aim for is to make the memory of homeland, ending of exile, real for us. And that probably could wait.
Yeah, I mean, in other words, what I'm saying is we should draw on our memory in some concrete way to enter into this before leaping over that into explanation of home in some psychological, metaphysical, or whatever. I don't know. I'm curious, but, you know, the group doesn't want to do that.
Well, it seems to me that's concentrating on the imaginative part, and the historical we would have to tie in. I think we've been neglecting the imaginative in some ways. But so.
Let's not. Let's just stop it.
It's also historical in terms of our history.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
And what that would say, given the concentric nature of the literature, is that the primal event becomes the principle of interpretation of your own history. Okay, so it's not that the two can't be related at all. They can't.
Yeah, the implication would be is that if you can't, that's what I'm just kind of discovering. If I can somehow entangle my own personal history in the history of the Old Testament, it won't be real to me in a biblical sense.
Yes.
It'll be a source of theological truth or whatever.
Okay. Well, that's
well, I guess, for example, that I would, I'm thinking of the verse in Hebrews that talks about how we're sojourners in this world or whatever, we're not at home. I don't mean that in a metaphysical kind of transcendent way, I'm sitting here waiting to all be at home, or whatever. But how one way that's kind of real to me is when I was reading that prayer thing on the nuclear war, and it talking about how, well, one thing I've been dealing with a lot lately is the idea that possession is an illusion and that we really possess nothing and that we can lose anything that we have at any time, like we've got an accident. You know, you don't even possess your body and anything can be taken away from you. And to me, home is a place where your things are and where it's more than that. But, you know, the idea that we can't, with the threat of nuclear war, this cannot really be our home. I mean, that's one example that I have to realize that I possess absolutely nothing, not even my body. This is not my home. I don't mean that in a kind of metaphysical, oh, I'm gonna go to heaven, I'll be just fine kind of way, but just the idea that to one that you do possess nothing in this world.
If you remember the we did talk about Deuteronomy sometime during this year. I think Dan talked about it. I think one of the most important risks, well, one of the most threatening risks that or dangers that the Queen of Israel came upon or faced was amnesia, forgetting. And for one of the things that they threatened to forget was that these things that were there, the land flowing with milk and honey, the houses that they did not build, vineyards that they did not plant were not their possessions but were the gift of God, and that possessions, well, like you said, ownership is an illusion in the biblical perspective. That's where the word stewardship, you are sort of overseeing the possession of another, and although we trivialize it by talking about church giving, that's a real fundamental part of the primal narrative. How about other experiences? I can think of one.
I was just thinking back one and earlier ago, but where in the context of relationship, we put five young idealistic hippies in a little house in West Bank. And for the first couple of years of that experience, it was some of the fondest home memories. Very cramped, very poor. But we just loved each other. We did together, you know. We bought an old pickup together and down there. You know, it was great. And I think most of that, it had nothing to do with that lifestyle so much as it is the lucky
one that I've had has to do with home is it has to do with it's kind of oblique and it has to do with wind. when I lived on a farm in Michigan, there were certain days when no place felt like home. And that was when they had these big cumulus clouds and about a 30-mile-an-hour wind. And if you know, maybe everyone's had the experience, but you sit at the window and you watch this wind whip across the fields and these clouds travel across. That there is just a powerful feeling of being in exile. In that experience, I don't know, has anyone else had that?
Yeah.
Like the whole world has left. Everyone's gone to the moon.
When you walk outside, it just feels uneasy.
And I've never been very comfortable with that. I've always been devastated by the, you know, how the weather, the wind, can do that to me. I mean, I'm not the kind that gets, you know, depressed on cloudy days and jumps around on sunny days. But the wind and the clouds always did that to me. Hmm. And I remember, usually, I would go out and try to face that. You know, when I was in high school and college, I'd be at home. It's especially moving on the lake, on Clear Lake, you get on the dock and the water turns black and you see this pattern of the water. And always to be out in it would have made the feeling much more intense. But I remember thinking at one time, just occurring kind of spontaneously, the wind blows where it will. You hear the sound of it, but you don't know where it's coming or where it's going. It was the first time that any kind of theological connection made any sense there, and really deepened an understanding of the word, Hebrew word ruah, which is the word for both spirit and wind, and the pneumas in the Greek, which is also spirit and wind. And after that, in my own experience, that somehow the spirit is the one that shakes your kind of moorings and makes you a sojourner. And that's maybe the one experience I have where the strong, you know, this primal narrative of what I remember about God's activity relates to a definite experience. I just can't shake it. That's
I can think of this sort of home experience, exile. It's my one time that I traveled out of the country. And there were two experiences of this on different levels. I went to visit my brother, who was in Peace Corps in Afghanistan. Spent 2 months there, and during the process of being there in Afghanistan, got to a fair speaking level on one of the local languages, Dari. Then after 2 months in Afghanistan, we went to do some traveling into India and Nepal. And in India and Nepal, there were many more English speakers than there were in Afghanistan. But I did not speak their native language. And so I always felt like a bit of a separation also. I knew much less about their culture. So even though the cultures were much more congenial than that of Afghanistan, the return to Afghanistan was in a way sort of coming back home. because I could speak the language of the people again. And it was just for a few days, and then I headed back to the States, and there was another homecoming, because there I not only was able to speak a language fluently rather than just on a very halting conversational level, but also I was back with people with whom the cultural assumptions were much more. I didn't have to explain myself all the time. The cultural assumptions were much closer. I guess I finished my story, but there would be two different kinds of homecomings there.
The first one reminded me of that little triangle, you know, how your origin was in Afghanistan, but somehow the experience, the significant event there, made it when it became a destination, kind of homecoming.
Yeah, in comparison, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess sort of a spiritual envisionment of coming home happened when we were in East Germany for 2 days, just kind of a field trip deal. And there were about three or four things that happened during that time that really gave you a sense of world community as being home, and it was really interesting. The first thing was going to Wartburg Castle, which all good Wartburg college students do if they go to East Germany. I mean, that's the first thing you do, drive in the border to go to Wartburg Castle, which gives you, it just kind of, you know, makes you feel like everything is kind of connected. The next thing that happened was we were on the interstate through Germany. The roads were built during Hitler's period to transport tanks and things. And we were in a big traffic jam. There had been an accident up above. And our college pastor went out to talk to some of the people in the traffic jam. And one happened to be an East German trucker who had to make it somewhere by such and such a time. He said, the traffic jam doesn't leave, you know, then I'll probably get reprimanded, blah, blah, blah. And what he said then was that, and here we are. I'm a man, and you're a man. And our two countries, why do they have this big separation? And this coming, you know, from a person that you're told is just basically evil because he's a Soviet person, you know, basically. And the next thing was the next day we were at I'm gonna lose my names all of a sudden. Where Martin Luther is buried. Where is that? I know it's in
Minneapolis.
It's Wittenberg.
Okay.
I think it's Wittenberg.
Below the floor of the church?
Yeah, well, he's anyway, anyway, we went to see the church, but it was closed. And so we went around and looked for we found out from some people who could open it for us. So we went around and looked for him, and finally found him as a pastor of another church there, but he had the key to this other church. And we all stood around Martin Luther's grave and sang Mighty Fortress Is Our God. You know, his family singing in German, and we all singing in English. And very moving experience. And then he told us a little bit about the church in East Germany and how it's really not repressed. It's just, there's no comment about it, so that it really loses all of its fervor. And then from this feeling of, you know, here are people that are really trying, you know, and a very moving type of thing, that here we were all singing, you know, a song, kind of our history coming from that. That really gave a feeling of oneness. And like,
around Martin Luther's grave, there was a home. Where is it? Kind of homing, being at rest.
Yeah, but it's very interesting being in East Germany around Martin Luther's grave in a socialist, you know, that the whole, you know, tension and everything, and yet it's at the same time. It's hard to explain, but really
pretty cool. That brings up and that was a central issue in the Old Testament story, and also the New Testament story. The Old Testament story, one's identity in the midst of culture and ethnic differences, and how do you live in the world but not of it. The Old Testament line is how do you maintain your identity and still be a blessing to the other nations around. The New Testament story, Jesus and the Samaritans, Jesus and... I guess the poor, lepers, people that come, you know, are marginal in terms of the cultural definitions. That somehow home has to be a place in spite of cultural and ethnic displacement, right? And that the home that God brings you to will be in spite of that sort of alien feeling.
There's one other thing. This is in the Soviet Union, which is also, you know, a very interesting place to be a Christian. And we went out to one of the churches there, and the church populace in the Soviet Union is basically old, although there's a movement, you know, towards younger. Most of the people who are, you know, the really true faithful ones are there all day long. They're old women, maybe 70, 80 years old, that have, you know, lived through this entire time of uprising and rebellion. And to go in and watch these women just praying and just feeling this really moving faith that God is with them in the midst of all this, you know, the horrible things that they've had to go through, is just really, you just feel that God's presence is everywhere. Even in the midst of it. Horrible, awful power, right? And that's our healing.
You know, just, that brings up a difference between Old and New Testament. The land of Israel. The way the church has described home, it's not a place. And maybe Jerry has started us off on something, you know, talking about the kind of home at rest one feels in Christian community. And you are speaking of that all over the world.
Yeah, the experience of mine that ties in with that. I hope this doesn't get too empty. I basically grew up in California, lived in Minneapolis for a while, but fifth grade through high school in California. Never had hardly any ties in high school. Music was about it. What I devoted all my time and attention to was the church group, and specifically a folk group, which we're having a 10-year reunion this summer. And that's where all my friends were. I had one friend that I kept track of after high school and high school, and that sort of slid too. But so all the people all the way from fifth grade to high school that I keep track of are from this folk group. And my senior year, my father was one of the executives out of a job in the job crisis in 74, which was very traumatic. We ended up moving to Bismarck after I graduated. He left 5 months before graduation. And going from suburban San Francisco to Bismarck, North Dakota was a different and one of the things about the folk group in California was that it was really a miraculous thing for just about everybody involved. The amount, we had an extremely talented group anyway, but it was a core group of talented people, five or six really excellent musicians, and then about 105 other people that just sort of tagged along. But you put everything together and it was really pretty good. And there was always a sense of miraculousness throughout the 3 years that I was involved with it, which made leaving all the more difficult. Anyway, ended up in Bismarck for 2 months that summer, and obviously the most depressing 2 months of my life. It was just terrible. And then going to college right after that, and getting another sense of, okay, here are people that I can relate to. I'm not totally alone anymore. I have a sense of identity. And coming to realize that I had placed my identity in with that folk group in that particular place, California. And in a sense, well, not in a sense, definitely was limiting myself by having to have that be with a certain group of people in a certain place at a certain time. And once that changed, it was totally disruptive. And it really came as a very deep understanding that in reality, identity isn't some sense bound up with a place, but in a much broader and in some ways much more pervasive sense, it really is placeless. Identity is related to where you are, but it's where you are too, personally. And ever since then, I haven't had major problems. Certainly, go to fits of depression when you're when you feel alone, like you can't relate to where you are. But I'm not afraid of leaving places that I really have enjoyed being at. Holden would be an example, and striking off on my own. And it's because of that experience and understanding that somehow within yourself, to a certain extent, your identity is a whole thing all by itself. And it does relate to where you are, but in, there's a deeper understanding of that in yourself. And can be anywhere on the face of the earth. But the, contrasting that with the Old Testament, which really was specifically a place, and that was the promise. The promise was the covenant. The promise was also a place.
Extend that a bit during the two. I really didn't begin with home. It's interesting that I was the one who put up that home is where you begin your origins, because both in the sense of place and the sense of family, I felt kind of in exile when I was a child. I grew up in Ohio, and I felt like I didn't want to be in Ohio, but I didn't feel any connection to it. And also because my parents, my father's roots were in Pennsylvania, my mother's roots were in St. Louis and Oklahoma, and that's where they're rooted. So I had no relatives or extended family around. And our family wasn't what we call strong or healthy. And I felt really rootless and dislocated. As a kid, I had passion for getting a corner or building a house. I had this thing, some secure, I was not in a secure and ordered place, and I really hungered for one. And so you might say I went out into the world looking for a home instead of leaving a home and then being an exile. And college gave me something like that. This was at my end of my sophomore year. I felt I was coming home and I was going to college, back to college. And when I married Ricky, then we went to Europe, and that was kind of discovering a new home, in that her family was very close-knit or whatever, and they went very far back in roots. When I went to the South for graduate school, I discovered another part of America. I realized something about the Midwest. The Midwest is really free-form, and no real time deficit. You know, you're just... And in the South, they remember the Civil War, for example. Who the hell in the North remembers the Civil War? Man, that was 100 years ago. The South, they remember the Civil War. Because they remember a lot of stuff. And then in the back of the parochial book. And one thing I thought was marvelous about Europe and Austria was that he was even more beautiful than I imagined. It was, you know, from the Gothic cathedral to the other. And in a sense, that was a kind of root. Behind America was Europe. And I knew that, and I'd always wanted to go back, and that was kind of time homeness. And then in the Far East, we went to Asia, and that was a different experience, because there wasn't a connection with Ricky, and there wasn't a cultural context, and I wasn't growing from Christian or Western spirit faith. So I became involved in with the people, and the place, we became precious. And so if I would return there, I have a kind of nostalgia for it. And in a way, that's another home. Where it comes back, it's kind of related to place, in that I thought back to the Vietnam War and the kind of pulverizing of the jungle and the destruction of Saigon and the culture. And I thought, well, gee, that, you know, that was a shame that that was happening. But it was kind of abstract. I mean, I didn't like the idea of people getting armed and wars getting defoliated. But it didn't have any personal grip the way the bombing of Chiang Mai in Thailand would have one. And that kind of speaks for travel. To the degree that you extend your sense of home, this also gets to what John was saying, to the degree that the home becomes larger and multiple, the earth becomes precious, and things like nuclear war become personal. You feel implicated in it. I mean, I feel awful if the places I've been in long enough to feel connected to them. well, because they're home in a way, and that speaks to the kind of church sense of extending home beyond a small place, because then the whole earth is precious. I mean, to the degree that you moved into it and connected it, you can't do that absolutely. And you feel a kind of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, without that, it's kind of abstract. I mean, those are human beings there. See them. Gee, it is a shame that a beautiful place would get bombed, but it's not the same as that's the place that I was. That's part of me. That's my history. That's my memory of getting. I can never return to that place and see it the way I do it. Because bombs are disintegrating. I mean, have you felt that?
Yeah.
In a way, that's an argument for the positive nature of the experience of religion, going away from home. That to wander is one way to realize where home is and to clarify that, and to become maybe more responsive and responsible to the place you end up.
Also, as you say, I remember kind of having a home in Northfield. There is some place that you do need to feel is your place.
Uh-huh.
I mean, even though home may, you may have a lot of homes, you do.
And the more obvious that home is where your things are. And I like what you said about that, because once you take the biblical mindset that those things are gifts, what your things really are, the promise, the future, the identity, belonging to the people of God, the way of God, really, really affects how you define your home.
Personally, at the earth as home, which means that you would have to travel to every place on the earth to really feel like that's home, is that the church can take as a body a number of people, a group of people with different experiences, and tie them together and then the miraculous thing happens that there is some greater power at work there that ties together those individual experiences. And so it's not, it can't just be a personal experience. That's part of life, but it has to tie in with the identity is not just a personal one. It ties in with a group.
One thing that's very obvious that the church claims to do is it is the source by which you find your identity. It says that it's the group of people here that speak and listen to one another that is the means of grace, that means helps you adopt this biblical way of seeing and make the memory of Israel and of the followers of Jesus your own. And so the church is corporate by its very nature because it's a memory that has to be passed on. You can't do it alone.
This will bring in another biblical image, Father, Children, in terms of home. And it gets at the thing, home can't just be in your head. As a kid, for sure, it can't just be in your head. I tried as a kid to make home inside my head, and it doesn't work as a kid. I think you're a little better at it, maybe, or you can never do it, but you can create something of that when you're an adult, partly because you can control more of your environment as an adult than you can. But then I think of our listeners' parents to Benno with all this traveling, which he has objected to. Our sabbatical year we spent in Austria, he was 3 or 4 then we went. And in summer, he'll go back. Well, all of us will go and then of the Far East, I can remember. The first time it came up when it was offered, and the car had, we were going to have a little raise this with Benno, and we didn't go as soon as we could because of Benno. And the car stalled, and we were walking back, and we were on the sidewalk, and Benno, around 8 years old, and I said, Benno, what if we went to the Far East? And he stopped it in the middle of the sidewalk, and he said, no. I'm not going, no. And he was not going to walk any farther down the sidewalk for until it was settled that we were that way. But so we waited a bit, and then we went. And, Scooby with him. A little bear. Scooby, we're going around. But he was talking that he didn't, he had reservations. Everyone said, oh, kids will love the Far East. But not Benno. Before, I had very mixed feelings for it, even sort of it seemed to me, from my perspective, that he was happy a lot of times, could see things, but the problem was he had to leave his friends. And he had no connection, and he really, at school in Thailand, he did have friends there, but not in the neighborhood. And then coming to Holden, okay, for sure we knew we couldn't go out of the country because of that, on this attack. And we wanted to bring him to Holden. And he had reservations there. Okay, how this relates to him is that as a kid, he needs rootedness. And he has this face, I'm an American, not something else. I'm a boy, not a girl. I mean, Ricky was trying to get liberated kid, but there's an important time in your growing up where I'm a boy, not a girl. This is very important to me now. I'm not into existential subtle identity. I'm just trying to get the basics. And I'm an American, and I'm proud of it. And that's my root. And he has parents that are continually pulling him out of that rootedness. And we did it, from our perspective, for his sake. We put him into exile. And he experienced it as exile. Because we wanted not just to have our own good time, though that's part, we were going after experiences for ourselves, but among other things, for example, to expose him to other cultures. That give him a sense that right, you are in America, but we want you to have an identity with a larger world, and we came to hold it for value reasons that we felt there were certain, just watching the two, stuff at home to pull out, and that's painful, but it gets into the thing of father-children relationships in the Bible, where the children, like Benno, hunger for a home, for rootedness, for a sense of identity, and that you really need it, and they have a vulnerability, and the father that puts the child or the children into exile and the kind of trust and risk that's involved there. From the parent's point of view, you feel implicated in that. You realize you're pushing your child. I mean, you're sensitive to the needs and demands of the child that are rooted in this. You realize that the child's limits are different than your limits. And you can't use your own nature to judge that. You can push a child too far. You're dislocating the child too much. And I don't know, that's just part of that biblical thing, because there is in that homelessness and exile the sense of children turning to the father. Why have you abandoned us? You know, we look to you for a home. We can't come up with a home on our own. Are you still there? You know that.
The story of what happened after the exile seems to connect to that. Israel's opinion split in many different directions. One was saying that the land is still important. That's the kind of home we need. There were others that, through the experience of wandering, and through prophetic tradition, that would say the wilderness is where we really lived in dependence. The land is, having a home has made us soft and amnesiac. And it's in that tradition that Jesus came. Jesus is closer connected to that than any idea of a real physical, cultural, ethnic home. And the story of the church afterwards with Paul putting to sea and never seeing his home again. And the story of early sojourners for the really, you get a strong idea that there was a change in the tradition, that home was no longer the promised land, but that home became something that God could give independent of your ethnic surroundings, independent of the soil on which you stood. And yet at the end, the heavenly city that comes down is Jerusalem, where all the... It's an odd tension.
When Ronald Reagan is referring to his campaign speech for the Shining City on the Hill being there, is he looking for the same kind of promised land vision, or is he just...
Well, the fact that it was such a crucial part of their, the religious settlers that came early, that was the vision that brought them through many devastating years, that they were coming to the new promised land, the new Canaan. And that's the vision that took people west. How the West was won, the promised land. That's always been a part of the American understanding. And I think, and you can correct me on this, I think what the biblical and the New Testament idea of home says is that it questions the idea of equating home with a political entity. See that? Home is not your country. And it says that, Jesus says that unequivocally. And that's one thing that civil religion tends to forget. Seems to make more sense to me is that the church is the political entity that stands against every country, is dispersed, and it has conflicts and a differing point of view than political nations, and there'll always be a tension. So some theologians don't agree that has to be that way. That's one conclusion I kind of draw from the biblical idea of homeland, the way Jesus talked about homeland, and the Christian church was dispersed among many different cultures.
It raises the whole issue of, and this is where we take off into other, Pharaoh and Moses supplying an alternative to the managed religion and state and existence of Pharaoh.
Israel had to cope with the same thing with the king. They established a political entity in the prophets, but to the end said that your identity is not dependent upon the existence of this political entity. And it was that the legacy of the prophets was the only thing that got them through the exile. Because the popular theology equated home with Jerusalem, home with the Davidic king, David's great-great-grandson. And so even in Israel, within the Promised Land, there was the idea that home could be in Babylon. Home did not depend, although it was clearly represented by the land of Canaan. And this is, I only mention this because it's such a strong temptation in this day and age when America and the capitalist world of freedom and democracy are feel pressed against the wall to equate. And I don't think anyone here has that problem.
Could that be somewhat the same kind of thing in relation to the family when Jesus said that you have to be willing to go against your brother or whatever, your sister? I don't know if you're giving that context, but to me, I think there's a lot of things that home is not, that we tend to think of. I mean, home has got to go beyond our family.
If you ever read the Gospel of Matthew all the way through, if you have time to do that every once in a while, go at it and looking at the references to family. Just kind of make that your point of reference as you go through. Matthew has an incredible amount to say who belongs to the family. And more than any of the other Gospels and all sorts of scattered stuff throughout there, people come and say, Jesus, your mother and brothers are out there. Jesus, well, who are they really? John the Baptist was saying that God could raise up from these stones children of Abraham, flying in the face of a very popular theological principle that, you know, of pure blood. Just throwing the membership in his family open to everybody. And Matthew has some incredible twists and turns with that. Struggle with this idea of home, because the idea of being committed to a place, having a place, I can watch the trees grow up, and that just is almost, it nears an idolatry with me.
what kind of this biblical is covenantal historical perspective, what does that say about the idea of long-term commitment to a farm and a community like that? What kind of vision does it give you for what's going to happen there and what you put your loyalty to?
I just had a mental picture of a good way of a relationship to a farm and a bad way of a relationship to a farm. The bad way can be, well, I won't even go into that because I think everybody has their own concept of that. But I tried to figure out the difference between the two, and I sort of keyed on, I think you mentioned earlier in the first session, response. And I can't quite remember the context, but it seems to me that unless you're living on a farm and it's a response out of something that has affected you, it has a greater tendency to not be a healthy relationship. In other words, if you try to make the farm something that you want, something that you need, or any time you are rooted in something and have a commitment to it, if you try to turn that into something that you want or need, you're losing the essence of the gift of it. If it's a response, oh, this is a gift, and you respond to that, then it's a more complete relationship.
Okay.
That's kind of abstract. But
well, I was trapping you here.
Home, as we've been talking about, is a gift. Place is a, what's the good word here? Responsibility. And they're not the same. The question I always ask myself is, well, suppose I'm here 30 years and I have to give it up. Either a highway goes through or they discover some
kind of uranium is found there.
What is my life going to be destroyed? Can I look at it as having exercised my responsibility and still have a home? Many people can't do it when they, move to town after selling the farm. They're dead in a couple of months.
Well,
Well, before you spoke, you got on another point that is kind of tough, but I think, too, like with what Dave was saying, that home being a gift takes the possession out of it. I think of coming out and forth with open hands, and the idea of holding whatever you have with open hands. You know, Abraham loved his son, but yet he was willing to lay down an altar or to just hold what you have with open hands. I think of the Erlanders just selling their house. That's something my parents have always lived in our house since I can remember, and I'm sure they always will. The idea that maybe when I'm 40 years old, I can totally start all over again, or to be able to let go. Not that you have to expect that you're going to have to give it up, but just that your attitude, this is a gift, and for however long I have it, I'm going to make the most of it. The other thing that what you brought up, I think of the responsibility part about it, and how what a place of your own does develop a sense of responsibility. I think of just working at a camp. And one summer I was nurse, and then the next summer I was a counselor. And the summer I was a counselor, I had my own kids to work with. And it made such a difference in how much I was committed to them, because these were the kids that I would be working with for a week. And they weren't just coming in to get a Band-Aid or coming in to get a headache, but it really kind of, there was a change in my attitude toward the children and then to other children because of that, because they were, wasn't just somebody I couldn't ignore. So it's hard. How do you hold something with open hands yet go at it like this is something that I'm holding as much?
The Deuteronomic answer, the mature theological reflection of the Old Testament is to do it remembering. That's their whole answer, is that you remember your identity and your past. And the biggest danger to a place is amnesia. It's interesting, it's the highest theological development of the Old Testament just merely says, just remember.